Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Chapter 30 of The International Jew by Henry Ford. 80 total chapters, produced over 91 weeks back in 1920-21, exploring all aspects of the Jewish problem or the Jewish question. Lately we've been talking in chapters 28 and 29 about the stage, and now we have one more chapter that'll close out the stage, and then I think we'll move on to movies. But let's get into it. Chapter 30, How Jews Capitalized a Protest Against Jews. You can find everything that we do, everything that we record, as part of the Learning College Vanguard Audiobooks at vnnforum.com. How Jews Capitalized a Protest Against Jews. The American stage is under the influence and control of a group of former bootblacks, newsboys, ticket speculators, prize ring habitués, and Bowery characters. That's the scum area of New York City. Bowery Boys. At the present writing, the most advertised man in the world of theatrical production is Morris Guest, G-E-S-T, a Russian Jew who has produced the most salacious spectacles ever shown in America. Aphrodite, which was referenced before, earlier chapter, and Mecca, Aphrodite and Mecca by Morris Guest, a Russian Jew. Remember, the small number of Jews in America before 1880 were mostly of German origin. After 1880, they came from Eastern Europe, and they were more Russian Jews. They were considerably cruder than the earlier ones, considered uncivilized by their fellow Jews. Anyway, these came in and dominated the stage business, theater business, is what we've been hearing lately. So he mentions Morris Guest, a Russian Jew who's produced the most salacious spectacles ever shown in America. Remember this, written in 1921. Aphrodite at Mecca. Two different publications. It is reported, or two different productions, it is reported that the scent of nastiness has been so strongly circulated among theater goers that tickets are sold a year ahead for the Chicago exhibition of one of these shows, the patrons being, of course, mostly Gentiles. Now, it is a fair question. Who is this Morris Guest who stalks before his fellow Jews as the most successful producer of the year? It is nothing against him to say that he came from Russia. It is nothing against him to say that he's a Jew. It is nothing against him to say that, although success has favored him, his father and mother are still in Odessa, or were until recently. Yet in a recent interview, in which the professional note of pathos was obtrusively present, he lamented that he was not able to bring his parents to America. The story of Morris Guest is the last one in the world to use as a success story of the type of the poor immigrant boy who became a great theatrical producer. He is not a great producer, of course, although he is a great panderer to the least creditable tastes of the public, whose taste he has been no mean factor in debasing. Guest sold newspapers in Boston and became a property boy in a Boston theater. In 1906, he was a member of a notorious gang of ticket speculators who were the bane of the public until ticket peddling on the sidewalks in front of theaters was suppressed by the police. There are still other stories told about him that link his name with another sort of traffic, but whether these stories are true or not, there is nothing in Guest's career to indicate that he would ever contribute anything to the theater's best interest. He is the son-in-law of David Belasco, B-E-L-A-S-C-O. Then there is Sam Harris, long the junior partner of the firm Cohan & Harris, who began his career in the arts by managing Dixon, the colored champion featherweight pugilist, and the redoubtable Terry McGovern, champion lightweight prize fighter. With tastes formed at the ringside at Terry McGovern and Dixon, black fighter, he launched into theatrical ventures, allying himself with Al Woods. He catered to the lower classes and made a fortune by producing atrocious melodramas in second and third class houses. And yet this is the Sam Harris who commands the patronage of hundreds of thousands, yes, millions of theatergoers, some of whom go on innocently believing that when they invade the theater, they also enter, by some mystical process, the realms of art. Al H. Woods has but one good eye. It is not his personal loss that matters, but the history of the misfortune, which goes back to the time when Al was a member of an East Side gang. The common report was that he used to play the piano in a downtown place, east of Fifth Avenue. Mr. Woods is also a distinguished patron of dramatic art. He presented, quote, The Girl from Rector's and The Girl in the Taxi, two of the most immoral and pointless shows of recent years. Several times he has secured the rights to certain Viennese operas, which were bad enough in themselves from a moral point of view, but which were at least constructed with true artistry. But even these he marred by an inept fusion of vulgarity and blag. The public, of course, does not see and does not know these gods before whom they pour their millions yearly, nor does the public know from what source theatric vileness comes. It is amusing to listen to the fledgling philosophers discuss the tendencies of the stage, or expatiate learnedly on, quote, the divine right of art, to be as flippant and as filthy as it pleases, when all the time the tendency is started and the art is determined by men whose antecedents would make art scream. The American theater is a small group of Jewish promoters and a large group of Gentile gullibles, and it is only the latter who kid themselves that there is anything real about the matter. It is perfectly natural, therefore, that the complete Judaization of the theater should result in its being transformed into the show business, a mere matter of trade and barter. The real producers are often not culturally equipped for anything more than the baldest business. They can hire what they want, mechanicians, costumers, painters, writers, musicians, with their gauge of public taste and their models of action formed upon the racetrack and the prize ring, with their whole ideal modeled upon the ambition to pander to depravity instead of serving legitimate needs, it is not surprising that the standards of the theater should not be at their lowest mark. And of course, notice that nowhere in this criticism does Ford grasp with the ultimate point of this degradation, per the Frankfurt School, which after all wouldn't arise till, it began around this time in Germany, would be to racially destroy the nation, not just morally and artistically, aesthetically destroy it, but those are a route to its general loosening, which makes it harder to perceive Jews and what they are doing, and ultimately to culminate in white genocide. So it does serve not just a commercial interest that he's pointing out, but it serves a political agenda. As theatergoers are noticing more and more, the Jewish manager, whenever possible, employs Jewish actors and actresses. Gentile playwrights and actors are steadily diminishing in number for want of a market. At times, the employment of Jewish actors has been so obtrusive as to endanger the success of a play. This was notably the case when the part of a young Christian girl of the early Christian era was given to a Jewess of pronounced racial features. The selection was so glaringly inept, ethnically and historically, that it militated strongly against the impression the play was intended to produce. The cover name conceals from the theater-going public the fact that the actors and actresses who purvey entertainment are, in large and growing proportion, Jewish. Some of the more prominent Jewish actors, many of them prime favorites, are Al Jolson, Charlie Chaplin, Louis Mann, Sam Bernard, David Warfield, Joe Weber, Barney Bernard, Ed Wynn, or to mention his real name, Israel Leopold, Lou Fields, Eddie Cantor, Robert Warwick. Among the prominent Jewish actresses are Theda Bara, Nora Bays, Olga Nethersole, Irene Franklin, Gertrude Hoffman, Mizzi Hajos, Fanny Bryce, wife of Nicky Arnstein, Bertha Kalish, Jose Collins, Ethel Levy, Belle Baker, Constance Collier. The late Anna Held was a Jewess. In addition to these, there are others whose racial identity is not revealed by their names or any public knowledge about them. The Jewish press claims for the Jews, aside from the commercial control of the stage, the control of the fun-making business. Think how Jews dominate standing comedy or improv comedy. The greatest entertainers, vaudevillains, and fun-makers are Jews, says an article to the Chicago Jewish Sentinel, commenting on the extent to which Jewish actors monopolize the Chicago stage that week. And that's where you have Second City, the improv, where a lot of the Saturday Night Live people from the Jew Lorne Michaels come from. Among the composers, we once beheld Victor Herbert and Gustav Kerker in honorable places, but now the Irving Berlins have forced themselves into places hewn out and established by Gentiles who had a regard for art. There are no great Jewish playwrights. Charles Klein wrote The Lion and the Mouse, but never repeated. There is, of course, much commonplace work turned out for the stage. A commercialized stage needs a certain amount of product. Among those engaged in such work are Jack Late, Montague Glass, Samuel Shipman, Jules Eckert Goodman, Aaron Hoffman, and others. The Jewish claim to exceptional genius is not borne out by the theater, although the Jewish will to power is therein amply illustrated. Belasco's name comes to mind, perhaps oftener than any, and Belasco is the most consummate actor of any off any stage. To understand Mr. Belasco is to understand the method by which the Independents fought the Jewish Theater Trust and still retain the monopoly of the theater for the Jews. The old trust was bowling along merrily, smashing everything in its way, thrusting honored stars into obscurity, blocking the path of promising playwrights, putting out of business all actors who would not prostitute art to commercialism. And there occurred what always occurs, for even the Jews are not superior to natural law. A bad case of big head was developed. Claw Erlanger and their immediate associates felt themselves to be kings and began to exhibit a few supposedly royal idiosyncrasies. There were some protests, of course, against the arrogance of the czars of the theater. The Vanderbilts and the other New York millionaires embodied their protest in a movement toward a national theater, which was erected at Grand Central Park, and for which $1 million was spent. One of the members of the trust proved his birth and breeding by saying that this attempt to cleanse the theater was really only a plan to provide a place of vice for the benefit of the millionaire backers. The remark inspired deep rancor, but was more revelatory of the Jewish trust's essential conception of the theater than anything else. Belasco came from San Francisco, where he had done various stunts, including those of an itinerant recitationist, illusionist, and actor. James E. Hearn took an interest in him as a youth and discovered him to be adept at helping himself to dialogues out of printed plays. Under Hearn, Belasco learned much about stage effects and soon became very successful in touching up defective plays. Coming to New York, Belasco fell in with DeMille, a Jewish writer for the stage, who only needed Belasco's sense of the theater to make his qualities effective. Belasco became a factor in enlarging the Jewish control of the stage in this way. He was connected with the Frohmans, but was unable to persuade them that Mrs. Leslie Carter, who had been the center of a sensational divorce suit and who had placed herself under Mr. Belasco's professional direction, was a great actress. The making of a star out of Mrs. Carter and the gaining of public recognition for her proved a long task. The Frohmans were unsympathetic. Then, among the managers, there was dissension, too. The Schuberts had been compelled to take the leavings of the other Jewish magnates, especially the leavings of Charles Frohman, and the Schuberts revolted. The Schuberts were natives of Syracuse, and their preparation for the theater was not promising of their devotion to art. They were the program boys and ushers. Then the haberdashery business claimed them as possibly a speedier course to wealth. Samuel Schubert eventually became a ticket seller in the box office. In due time, having learned a few marketable secrets of the theater, he launched a frivolous burlesque and comedy show. With this, he floated into New York and continued with his musical shows of a shallow kind until the name Schubert has come to be descriptive of the productions. The Schuberts, of course, booked in trust theaters. About the year 1900, the Schuberts quarreled with the trust, and Belasco quarreled with the Frohmans, and the two hailed each other as fellow belligerents and proceeded to see what could be made of their belligerency. The public was showing signs of distrust or disgust with the trust. That was the cue. The Schuberts and Belasco would appeal to the public to help in the fight against the trust. Belasco and the Schuberts would play the part of injured independents. Public sympathy would be aroused, and public patronage would boost the independents into the strength of a new trust. That is exactly what occurred. Belasco's theatricalism helped to this end. He is an actor off as well as on the stage. He affects the pose of a benevolent priest and dresses the part, wearing a priestly collar with clerical vest and coat. Although of Portuguese Hebraic origin, Belasco dresses after this manner to honor, as he says, a tutor of his early days. Anyway, the costume is very effective, especially with the ladies. He has a tremulous, shy way about him, and he sits in his sanctum with the lights so arranged that his priestly face and splendid shock of silver hair seem to rise out of an encompassing and shadowy mystery. It is very effective, very effective. One woman declared, after being admitted to the presence and gazing on the face that rose out of the shadows into the light, "I have a better understanding of the divine humility of Jesus Christ since I have been privileged to meet Mr. Belasco." Thus the Master, as he was called, was well equipped to appeal to public sympathy, and he did appeal. There was no end to his appeal. He told stories of personal attacks made on him. He wrung his hands in desperate grief against the trust menaced to the stage. His own productions, however, were not all immaculate. There was one, Naughty Anthony, which brought the police censor down upon him. But there was a very clear conception in the public mind as to what the trust had done to the stage. Belasco said he was against the trust, and the rest was snap judgment. The Schuberts and Belasco thus found themselves in a very favorable combination of circumstances. Their first financial aid came, strangely enough, through ex-Congressman Reinach, R-E-I-N-A-C-H, a Jew, Boss Cox of Ohio, Boss in quotes, and others who were interested. These supplied the first money. The Schuberts supplied the management. Belasco supplied the wonderful impersonation of a Daniel come to call the Jewish Theater Trust to judgment. The campaign succeeded and the wealth rolled in. For a time, Belasco did prove to the public that he could produce better plays than the old trust had given to the public, and to that extent he justified public confidence in him. The end of the old trust came in a natural way. The Schuberts became rich and powerful, and the trust was then willing to do business with them. Some members of the trust died, and about 1910 the old trust ceased to exist as the dominant factor in American theatrical affairs. But the rise of the independents did not bring relief. It only captured for Jewish enterprise that part of the theater which might have become the prize of a legitimate body of protesters against the old cheapness and vulgarity. The pretended protest won. The theater was saved to Jewish control. So there's a good example of the Jews creating and leading the opposition. So that you always have to be aware of fake opposition is a term used elsewhere in either the protocols or Ford's discussion of the protocols. Jews never end with creating false fronts, including the best way to defeat your opposition is to create and lead it. Lenin Trotsky idea. Jewish managers had created the public disgust in the first place. They knew what the public reaction would be, so they prepared to capitalize the reaction and thus control the theater-going public, both coming and going. So they're not only the new establishment in the theater, they are the fake opposition to that establishment. They control, just as they control the politics in the U.S. with one party, with two factions, throughout the Reds, throughout the Blues, Blue State, Red State, Conservative, Liberal, but they all end up pushing the same agenda. They did it with admirable strategy, says Ford. During the outbreak, there was some genuine feeling of independence on the part of a few non-Jewish managers. John Court organized a Western theater circuit. Colonel Henry W. Savage swung loose from Claude Erlanger, as did also William A. Brady. But independence of the Jewish control has never flourished. Wherever it did keep up an independent front, it stood for the theater in its best sense and served as the only channel of expression for the few remaining stage artists. The coming of the motion picture industry, however, gave true independence its quietus. The motion picture industry, and it is rightly named an industry, is entirely Jewish controlled, and as it is pushing its way into the legitimate theaters and crowding out human players for long periods every year, theater managers have to bow to it more and more. It remained for the Schuberts, however, to give the theatrical business a most original twist. They made it a real estate speculation. Readers of this article may recall that recently they have read that in their own or a neighboring city, the Schuberts are going to build one or two theaters. In one city, the announcement was made that two theaters were to be built. That particular city happens to need almost everything but theaters. However, it cannot get anything else it needs, and there is no doubt it will get the theaters. The Schuberts learned this trick when they were supposed to be bucking the trust. They went after any building they could get, and because of the public enmity to the trust, they got better terms than otherwise could have been possible. An old writing school in New York became the Winter Garden. The Great Hippodrome, the materialized dream of a non-Jew, Frederick Thompson, was taken over by the Schuberts. It soon dawned on the Schuberts that there was more money in theatrical real estate than in theatrical art. Today, the Schuberts, while nominally theatrical managers, are really dealers in theatrical leases and buildings where theatrical productions are made. A theater, as a real estate proposition, pays amazingly well. Figure up the amount of space you occupy as a show, the length of time you occupy it, and the price you pay for it. It is rent raised to the nth degree. Then the offices which make the bulk of the structure and the stores in front. Really, the show business, end quotes, is the minor consideration. What does it cost the Schuberts? Well, very little but their use of their name. When it is the matter of a new theater, outside capital supplies 3/4 of the money, but the lease and the control are vested in the Schuberts. That is a rather handsome arrangement. In the matter of producing plays, the same arrangement is also often followed. In the matter of producing plays, the same arrangement is often followed. The author, star, or the backers supplying the larger part, sometimes all of the capital, while the Schuberts lend their name to the management and take their share of the booking fees and the rental of the theaters where the show is produced. So they're probably taking all of the profits and getting rid of all of the risk, which is on the people who put up the money in case their play flops. In October of last year, 1920, a serious slump hit the theatrical business. Even in New York, the theaters were experiencing the worst depression of years. More than 3,000 actors were idle, and managers were compelled to resort to cut-rate ticket agents to sell their seats. And yet in the midst of it, Schubert announced 6 new theaters for New York alone. At the same time, they announced the production of 40 plays. 40 plays. If a man announced he was going to build 6 new art museums in one city and fit them up with a requisite number of oil paintings produced under his own direction, he would be considered crazy, especially if it were a matter of common repute that he knew nothing of art and was having the pictures painted merely to give value to his real estate. It indicates how thoroughly accustomed the public has become to, quote, the show business and the, quote, motion picture industry, that the announcement of these former haberdashers, that is, a man who supplies hats, is taken so complacently. 40 plays. When anyone can count on his fingers of both hands all the present-day American and English playwrights even remotely deserving of notice. It is said that the Schuberts do not expect more than 3 out of 40 plays to succeed. The success of a play in the artistic sense is not their business. To maintain enough plays on the road to keep alive their real estate investments is really the thing. Thus, it is now not strange where theatrical slang comes from. An actor who wins success is said to have delivered the goods. An approved actress is all wool and a yard wide. An author puts it over on his audience. A girl of no particular class is a skirt. A young chorus girl is a broiler or a chicken. An actress who plays the part of an adventuress is a vamp. A very successful play is a knockout. Taken all together, it is the show business, in quotes. This is the effect of Jewish control of any profession, as any American lawyer will tell you. The only protest now being offered is by the small dramatic clubs, which, whether or not they or know it, are the strongest, quote, anti-Semitic, unquote, influence on the theatrical horizon. And that's what they were printing in the Dearborn Independent on the 22nd of January, 1921. So we hear about the Jews control the theater, and they are continually looking for easier ways to make money. They turn the theater from an art into an industry, into a business. Get rid of the old stars, institute production values, form a trust. We heard now about a second trust that arose, sort of a controlled opposition, fake opposition party. And then next, the scene will shift to the movies, which would seem to offer even more profits. But we heard last segment that Ford said outright that where most of the young people got their ideas was from the theater. And so the theater was sort of the early version of TV in terms of influencing public morals. Anyway, that will do it for Chapter 30 of The Unabridged, The International Jew by Henry Ford. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.